ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Imagine waking up in one of the wettest places on the planet, covered in sandfly bites. You haven't found food for days. You can't remember the last time you were warm. And you're completely on your own. Indefinitely. While it sounds like the premise of a horror movie, it is actually the second season of SBS reality show Alone, where 10 survivalists compete to see who can last the longest alone in the wilderness. You might remember season one of Alone Australia, where contestants were dropped off in remote Tasmania. This time, they're on the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the stakes are even higher. To find out more, I spoke with executive producer Rima Dea about how Alone Australia conveys a custodial relationship with land, and how her own love of the show changed when she went from being a viewer to executive producer.
It's one of those things where it's an education all the time. You're always learning on the job with this one, and that sounds like a cliche to say something like that, but you're listening a lot more than you're telling or instructing. And that's kind of the opposite of what you normally do in TV. You're not often producing and instructing and directing the talent, the scenes, the content, the storyline. And this is one where everything is flipped. And as the producer, you're not producing, you're sitting back and observing and listening. And that's different each time in each scenario, on each different piece of land with each different participant. They're all telling you different things and they're doing different things. So it's fascinating in that sense. You know, you're an observer more than you are a producer, and you're guiding the story that they're telling you rather than getting them to tell the story you want them to tell, you know? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Alone Australia season two has taken place in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I mean, the big question that has come up is why there? What was it about that landscape or that place that drew you guys?
Look, I've always had a love affair with New Zealand, and I think anyone that's been there does, falls in love with that place. So it was on the radar right from the outset when we were looking at all of the places that we could make this series. And it's really important for us that every series is about taking Australians to somewhere, ideally, that places them all on the same level, same playing field, same starting line for the most part, but takes them out of their comfort zone. So the element of surprise is important for them. The element of discomfort is important for all of them. But also the element of hunting was really important. And there was a big appeal with how easily we could obtain bow and arrow hunting permissions in New Zealand versus most of Australia, because it is a very practiced, I'd like to say, hunting country. Tramping is very common, but a lot of New Zealanders, especially in the South Island, self-sustenance hunters, a lot of people will go out and hunt their venison, hunt their deer, and fish for their fish. And their fridges are filled with wild caught meats. They don't go to the supermarket as often as we do for the most part. It's really amazing. And so there's this really healthy hunting culture. So it was really easy to tap into as opposed to in Australia. And that was a big appeal, to be able to up the ante and to offer the participants something that was new from season one and was a surprise from season one as well. So they applied not knowing they'd be allowed to bow hunt. It wasn't until very late that they knew what that was on. So it's fun to sort of come at them without them knowing where we're coming from and go, here's your 10 item possibilities, and then see what comes of that.
At what stage do you actually get to choose your 10 items? Like, do you know where you're going when you're making that choice?
No.
Wow.
No. They don't know where they're going until they're there. And even then, we don't confirm for them where they are. So they have a sense of where they're flying to when they receive their itinerary the week before they fly. So they know what airport they're going to. But they've chosen their 10 items way before that. You have to go into this show with the mindset that I'm going to survive a plane crash, but I've got no idea where the plane's going or where it's going to land. I just have to be ready to survive anywhere, essentially. So that makes it harder and more interesting, and that also evens the playing field, because it stops people from being able to potentially go to that place ahead of series and get some practice on the land. So we keep it a well-guarded secret right up until the last minute.
Now, Rima, you were the executive producer of season one of Alone Australia as well. I'd love to know, what did you learn from that experience that has shaped the way you've approached season two?
Because of the nature of where we were coming from as a production team, all of us, we're a very small team. We built relationships with these 10 people. So it's months of relationship building and getting to know them. And because we wanted to know them so well, we came at it from a different point of view. We were talking human to human instead of producer to cast member. You have to, because they have to trust you with their lives and to allow their stories to be told the way that they have recorded them as much as possible. And so there's a big element of trust from them to us, and from us to them, we're trusting them to make the content. And so it wasn't deliberate, it was innate that the relationship building became a really important part of that series. But we saw how important that was once they were out there, especially for them to be able to open up, you know, for Chris to be able to keep rolling on a PTSD episode, for Gina to turn the camera on when she was grieving Blaze in that incredibly brave, honest moment, you know, for Beck to turn the camera on and swear complete fear, looking around going, there's bloody Tasmanian devils here, I'm sure of it. You know, she could have not turned the camera on, but they trusted us and let us in. And, you know, the more they went along, the more important that relationship was. So what we learned really was this is about relationships and this is about trust. And this is about sitting back and not trying to control anything. Let the story come to you. Let these 10 people step into this new landscape. Let the protagonist do her job and challenge them as much as she can possibly challenge them. And let's see what they bring to that fight and to that joy.
On a way, obviously, like, we're concerned with First Nations arts and culture. And so something that I have been really interested in terms of Alone Australia is the way that the show approaches country and the way that the show approaches the environment that these people have gone into. I wonder if you could tell me a little about any cultural consultations that took place when it came to this second season.
The way we approach making this program is once we've found the land that we think will really work from all of those gazillion criteria that have to come together for that land to be appropriate for the series, our next step after working out who owns that land currently is to get the best possible consultation on how to make this series in this particular place. And so it's a no-brainer that the first thing we need to do is find out who were the first people on this land that we can consult, who have had the longest experience living on this land and have the most information to share with us. And that's the First Nations people of that land. So for us, we were very lucky in season one. We had excellent Palawa consultation right from the outset. It's the first thing we do. And so it's there right from the outset in terms of us understanding what land we're on. And then it informs us in terms of heritage, culture, the land itself, understanding how the flora and fauna on that land works and what you can and can't do with it, and hundreds of years of learnings that you can't get anywhere else, right? So we got that in Tasmania, but in New Zealand, in Te Waipounamu Aotearoa, we were lucky enough to tap into the Ngāi Iwi, who are the principal tribe of the South Island. So there's lots of tribes that come under Ngāi, and they are very organised iwi, lots of consultation every time we asked for something, whether it was cultural heritage or flora, fauna, or whether it was edibles or whether we wanted to know about shelter building. They always knew who to draw upon to help us out with that information. So there was a wealth of information right from the outset, and then we were welcomed onto that land spiritually as well by Ngāi, who and the participants will talk about this potentially if you're speaking to them. It was just such a wonderful experience to be welcomed onto a marae through Porphyry. Have you experienced that?
I haven't myself, but I've spoken to other people who have, and just like they talk about, because it's the singing people in, yeah. Yeah, and the way that those songs just kind of hit you in the chest.
Oh, I tell you, it's like a punch to the heart and a hug of the heart at the same time. It's powerful. And, you know, I've done it twice now. I've had the, it's a privilege. It really is a beautiful, wonderful experience to be welcomed. It's so beautiful. But the first time I did it with other execs, and the second time was with our cast. And I saw people cry who don't normally cry. You know, it just comes out of you. This emotion just gushes out of you. It's such a raw emotional experience, and you can't really explain what it is, but it's beautiful. It's just highly recommend it. if you can enjoy a Porphyry, I highly recommend you do. So we were welcomed on to the Madai through Porphyry, and once that happened, we were also welcomed into the kitchen with the whole community, and we had Kai. They'd cooked an amazing meal for us. I still want that chicken recipe. And it was just a beautiful welcoming into that particular iwi's land and into their community, and we were welcomed as whanau family. And then from there, we also had cultural awareness training and heritage training. And then we were also, all of the cast were taught a karakia. And a karakia is an incantation that calls to ancestors a spiritual welcoming and protection while you're on that land. And it was one of those things that really resonated with our cast, especially our First Nations cast, who really felt the need to be welcomed by the ancestors and the spirits onto the land. And all of the women as well, I think, really, it really resonated with them. Not for any particular reason, but they're the ones that fed back that karakia and that porphyry and that welcome from the Ngāi-Tahu iwi really made them feel safe and welcome on the land. They never felt uncomfortable at night, which some of them were anticipating.
I think that's the thing that I really notice, is that your participants, your cast members, don't necessarily seem to be in competition with their landscape. They're in community with it. They're thinking about it in a really different way.
They really are. And I think that's where our First Nations influence comes in, both Series 1 and Series 2. There's a shared knowledge that, look, I think a lot of them come to this competition, I don't like to call it a competition, but they come to this experience with that ethos and that principle and that philosophy, however you want to look at it. They take learnings from First Nations people in terms of that custodial approach to land, that respectful approach to land and looking after land. And that's an important part of our casting process, that these cast members are that way inclined to begin with. So there's an ethical and a moral fitness that we start with as well in our casting process. But there's so much learning that happens in boot camp as well, where that shared knowledge just imparts that approach to their interaction with the land, and they all seem to take that in with them.
That was the executive producer of Alone Australia, Rima Dea. If you were wondering what it might have been like to compete on this season of Alone, Jason can tell you. He's a Yanyuwa Wanyi Garawa man from New South Wales and one of 10 survivalists who took part in Season 2 of Alone Australia. He's also an extremely social person by trade, so I wanted to know what compelled him to take part in the show.
I'd seen the American versions and watched most of those seasons, and the whole time screaming at my screen, I could do that, I could do that. But yeah, I do have a fair bit of experience with outdoorsy stuff. I've been hunting since I was 5 or 6, and likewise with fishing, and just always been outdoors in some format or other, whether it's camping or hiking, bushwalking, all manner of activities outside. So I just thought it was something that would put some of my skills to use. And it's a very unique show in that there's not really any trickery or anything. It's just you in the elements for as long as you can last, which is a pretty cool concept. So yeah, that was why I wanted to give it a go.
I mean, you talk about having grown up around the bush. I also grew up around the bush, and I have had no impulse to try and to try and live alone out in the wild. Like, it's a pretty phenomenal and I don't know. It's a huge thing to undertake. How do you actually prepare once you've found out you're...
Once I found out I was in, I tried to make fires as much as I could. So I live on 100 acres outside of Tamworth, and I do have a fire that needs lighting every night. So, I just practiced all different ways, especially when it was wet. I didn't know exactly where we were going to be, but I figured it would be cold and wet and miserable. So that was something that I thought was a real necessity, to just become really proficient and comfortable lighting fires in any environment. I think I just tried to mentally prepare as well. I mean, it's one thing to practice all those things, but I think, you know, a big part of any endeavor is getting your head right and getting, you know, making sure that you're, you know, you're fully there and you're fully kind of ready for anything, whatever that looks like.
You're a community leader, you're a youth worker, former rugby league player and coach. Like, all of that says to me that you are a very social person. How do you actually prepare to be alone?
Yeah, I think you can't really. I mean, you can in the sense of, like, yes, you can go out and spend a few days camping or, you know, go on a solo hike or something like that. But I think whenever you do an activity like that, you've always got that little thing on the horizon that says, okay, I'm going home on Sunday, or I've got to go back to work tomorrow, or, you know, next week I'll be back at work, or whatever it might be. And with this, there's no light at the end of that tunnel. You're there as long as you can be there. And so that side of it was very hard to prepare for. And I've done lots of stuff out in the wilderness, but I've always, even though I thought, I'm like, oh, I don't mind being by myself and I don't mind my own time, it's completely different. You know, having that, I mean, even when you're by yourself, you're still, whether you're driving in your car or you're like got your headphones on walking down the street, you still pass people, you still see people in the street, you still interact without interacting, if that makes sense. So, yeah, that I don't think there's anything that can really prepare you for not seeing people or not having people around you, even though you might not be necessarily socializing with them directly. So, yeah, that was interesting.
I mean, Jason, did it change how you think about community?
Definitely. Like I touched on, I've always thought, oh, you know, I'd be fine if I had no human contact and I could be one of those guys that builds a log cabin and you don't see me for 30 years. But I think that you really do need human interaction and human engagement. Like I said, even if it's seeing your mailman put something in the post or something, you know, it's something as simple as that. It doesn't sound like much, but when you haven't seen people for an extended period, you're like, oh, okay. you really do notice it. So yeah, it's that side of it was tricky and interesting. I definitely did get a stronger appreciation for, you know, family and community and friends and just the everyday of, like, you know, getting up and going to work and seeing the same folks every day and, you know, getting your coffee at the shop and all those little things, those little seemingly meaningless interactions that you have with people every day become like, oh wow, like that's, you know, you really notice that that's the social fabric that you're sort of weaved into. And when you take all that away and there's no people and there's no cars and all that sort of stuff, it really does take you to an interesting place, I think, psychologically and physically. So yeah.
I know we talked about the fact that as a Yanyawawani Garawa man, you've been learning traditional methods of hunting and fishing, of foraging. But this season 2, took place in Aotearoa, New Zealand. That is a very different climate. So what was your first thought when you found out you're going to be there?
Oh, damn. oh, darn. Yeah, look, that's exactly right. I in the last sort of decade or so, I've reconnected with mum's family and, yeah, been particularly while I was living in the Territory, was going out on country fairly regularly. I worked in a school up in Darwin for quite a few years, so every school holidays I'd sort of go out for the break and spend time with my brothers and sisters and cousins out there, basically just going bush, going fishing, hunting. But yeah, the Gulf Country is pretty nice, particularly in the dry season. You know, it's a very different climate to South Island, New Zealand. So that was definitely... I don't know. I had a feeling that we wouldn't be, I don't know why, but I just had a feeling it wouldn't be in Australia. I don't know why, but I sort of thought, oh, maybe we go somewhere, you know, abroad somewhere. Can't explain what made me think that. But, yeah, when I found out, I was like, oh, okay. Probably the first thing I thought of was like, I don't know anything about that environment apart from the fact that it's, you know, very cold, very wet, snows, very rugged, very mountainous. But apart from that, yeah, very, very little and pretty different to most of the stuff that I've experienced. I did grow up in the Upper Hunter Valley on a big cattle station that was, we used to get snow every year and it did get quite cold, as did Tamworth, but it's a different cold. It's not a whole other level. It's not quite the same. So yeah, that was interesting.
I have a really practical question for you. Contestants are allowed to select 10 items. What did you choose?
I don't think I can say all 10 just at the moment. I can give you 3 items that I selected. So number one was my multi-tool or Leatherman. Yeah, I've always got one of them on my person. They're a very handy little piece of kit. Number two was a ferro rod or a ferrocidium rod for starting fires. And number three was a bow and arrow.
I remember in season one, Gina, who ultimately won, quite famously chose not to take a sleeping bag. She was the only one to not choose a sleeping bag in her 10. I mean, how much strategy goes into selecting your items?
Yeah, you definitely have to think about what you take. For me, there's no way I wasn't going to take a sleeping bag. Gina had the big possum skin coat, which was amazing and served her quite well. But yes, with the strategy side of things, you do have to think about it. It's tough though. Like I said, I mean, I don't know a great deal about, you know, that area. So
you're flying blind.
You kind of are flying blind in a way. Look, it's one of those things. I think there's always something that you wish you have. I mean, I have that even when I leave to go to work. I always forget something or there's something. I think, oh, wouldn't it be good if I had that? And it's the same when I go camping or hunting. Having said that, though, I can't think of any of my items that I would have swapped or traded out. That side of it definitely is tough because you do have to narrow down to 10 items and, hope that they sort of serve you well and that they're going to be useful and that you're going to use them all the time.
That you didn't just lug them for nothing.
Yeah, you're not.
That's along it. With your many kilos of cameras. Because you have to become a bit of an amateur documentarian.
Yes, that side of it definitely is tough as well. Especially when it's, you know, cold and wet and you just feel like not doing much. But the camera, the what do you call it, the camera equipment is, that's definitely another element of it as well, because you obviously, that's the whole point, we're there, we've got to document this journey that we're taking. So you really have to, I guess factor that into your day-to-day as much as you can, so that you're capturing those moments as they happen. Mm. So
I feel like one of the really special things about Alone Australia is I genuinely feel more than any other like iteration of Alone is engaging with First Nations people and like thinking about country in that kind of way. Like,
oh, definitely. I think, my experience anyway, there's definitely a celebration there to, you know, for people like myself to be able to share a little bit about myself and my, you know, different things that I've done in the past and, to help me tell this story as it happens. So, I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head. It does. We did meet with some traditional custodians over there, which was really nice. They, we got to spend a little bit of time with them pre-going in. Yeah, learned a little bit about the significance of the area that we were in and, got to go do like a, I guess almost like a welcome to country or equivalent to that, which was really special. Sort of for me anyway, felt like a bit of a grounding and a bit of a, you know, okay, I'm here and going to try this crazy thing. So got the blessing of the old people from that area, which was, very special.
Jason Allwood there. He's a Yanyuwa Wani Garawa man and one of 10 people who've taken on the challenge of competing in the second season of Alone Australia. You can watch Jason and the rest of the Alone Australia crew on SBS every Wednesday at 7:30 or catch up on SBS On Demand from 8:30 p.m.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.